You just have to keep going. You have to want it enough to wake up tomorrow and do the same thing over.
This was me being a hustler.
The only way that I've gotten to this point in my life is to try to treat people the way I want to be treated.
Welcome to Ground Zero Growth with your host, Sam Sapp, owner of Lockbaud.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Ground Zero Growth. I'm joined today with my guest, Mark Schaefer. How are you doing today, Mark?
It's the last day of the year. We're ready to kick off 2026 in a day. So I'm good.
No kidding. What a way to kick off and close out the year, huh?
Yeah. Momentum's carrying over. So I'm excited for 2026.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too. That's fantastic. So tell me a little bit about your firm, Searcy Financial, right? And you're currently the president of this firm. Yeah.
I'm the CFO. We do have a president and CEO. That's not me. I don't focus on operations, but I get to focus on financials and lean into growth for the company, focusing on business development and kind of being a face. So I get seen a little bit more than others, but we've got a great team of, we added someone new, I think 14, I think. So good people and a lot of remote people. So some people, the Kansas City people won't meet because they're not here very often.
That's fair. And you really get out there for being the CFO. I mean, you're kind of all over a little bit, unless I'm wrong. We met originally through Share Your Story.
Yes.
Yeah. And it was really cool. And I think the reason we met is because, you know, I like getting out there and meeting folks. And I have kind of this particular style of networking. And I think Chloe had the notion of like, hey, you know, you should meet Mark. And I think she was dead on, too. I've since read your book, One for All. That's a good book. And I like the sort of Three Musketeers reference, if you will, in the name. Or at least I'm assuming that's the reference, right?
There's some reference to that, yes, but One for All, helping everybody is the premise, but yes, and I haven't yet read your book, but it's been fun to collaborate on ideas and see yours come out shortly after mine did. So we're both kind of in that same space for riding a wave of whatever it brings, right?
What had you write that book? What was kind of the key sort of trigger decision, like this is the book I need to write, it needs to be, because it's essentially about like systematizing connecting with people, but not just connecting with people, following through with what you say you're going to do and meaningful interactions.
Yeah, it came around as an idea 10 years ago when the founder asked me to write a process for how I was developing some new business and didn't have a resource of Share Your Story 10 years ago. So an idea didn't come until 10 years later. So it was meant to be an internal, create a culture. The whole Irish proverb in the book that we focus on, handed out in slices, it comes back in loaves. I've been doing that at this company now for 20 years. And I want everybody else to see that that can be done. You don't have to be a salesman. You don't have to be an extrovert. You can just be in a mindset of helping people and making sure they understand what you do so that if they need what you do professionally, you're available. That's it. And the reason I systemized it, like you said, is because when everything gets busy, you some things go. So if you have a process for following up and staying front of mind and doing it authentically to the extent that you can, good results happen. It just takes time. And nobody's in a hurry at my firm. It's like some people are on a 10-year timeline. Some people need business tomorrow, and we're happy with whatever comes up from it as it relates to slices coming back to us.
Well, and you definitely, I mean, the saying, you know, you fall to level of your systems, right? Mm-hmm. It, I think is definitely applicable. So,
yeah, lots of good books read in the past kind of shared into what I put inside of my book. So it's what works for me, but it's not an end all be all. And I tried to keep it short. I think you can read it in a couple hours, although it took me a lot longer to record my my audio version because I read my own book at a studio and that was interesting. Lots of mess ups, but I wanted it to be able to be read like on a flight going somewhere. So it's not, my attention span is not what it used to be. I don't know if you have that, but man, if I don't have a book that's real long right next to me, but sometimes it looks like a great book, but I'm too intimidated to even start. So mine is not that book. Yours is not that book either.
Yeah, no, and I know what you mean. Yeah, for sure. Yes. In general, well, it's a great example to that end. I'm such a fan of the book Atlas Shrugged. It's a very good sort of philosophical. I bothered to, because I was over here like, man, I say this book to folks, and then I have to immediately like warn them because they're like, oh man, I got to go get the book. I got to read the book. And then I have a moment of like, well, actually, I think it's three books, and it is the length. I bothered to Google it because it's about 10,000 words short, but it is the length of Lord of the Rings. So it's like 150,000 some odd words or something like that. And Lord of the Rings is like 160 or something.
But if you break it down to smaller things, then for me, that's you said three books. I would break it down into 10 and then I might start.
There you go. Well, yep. It definitely helps that it carries sort of a fantastical sort of arc. Oh. It's an interesting book. So that's exciting. Okay, so then the Share Your Story came along, and you were like, we can change this into a book. So it started almost like an SOP. Am I?
Oh, to some extent.
Following correctly?
It wasn't going to be a check the box type of thing for a process. It was more of a philosophy and a culture. And so it was easier to tell in a book. And although I didn't anticipate this when I wrote the book, it turned into a lot of stories of what worked as examples of what people should be trying and focusing on. Because otherwise, it's do this. I thought that's what it was going to be. And now it's just a lot of good stories that lead to that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. You hint at this a little bit in the book, which I absolutely love. By the way, so this was another thing I kind of appreciated. In reading the book, I feel like you did a good job of kind of like, most of the time when you write a book, it's like one side of the story, right? Okay, handout, loves, it comes back in slices. But then nobody talks about the flip side of it, which is kind of like, well, where do you temper back? Where do you stop? Where do you, there are some relationships where eventually you're giving away all the bread and you're kind of like, I don't know where. And it's not always just about return, but it's also about, it's interesting because, and I would love to discuss this phenomenon more, I've started to learn, and I've leaned into, there's a biblical concept to it as well. It's like, look, when I get handed out in slices, let's say, I don't necessarily have to see a return by any stretch, but I do want to see, perfect world, somebody does something with that, right? Uh-huh. There's a multiplicative return to your effort.
I'll say this, with the rest of the team that hasn't been around that long time, you and I have known each other less than 6 months, so there's a lot of history of things that you don't know, my team doesn't know, and what appears to be overnight success is a series of hundreds of things, right? The slices handing them out that people don't see, but they see that yesterday someone said yes to a good thing that might have meant revenue or hiring us. And that's what people judge everything on, is revenue. But I would kind of turn it into two things. Is part of, I don't have a study on this, but I'm sure they're out there. You feel better about the giving, and can be said financially by doing kind deeds, from doing good things for people. That has an emotional return that makes you feel better about everything. So I love that, and I focus on that. And sometimes, even though something came back, I credit it karma in the world by the three things I did yesterday. So it's not a return on something I did 10 years ago. It's just, I guess, circular and evolving over time. But to your point, there's got to be a time when there's another book and I can't read it. It talks about givers, takers, and matchers. And I'm a giver, but at some time, you're giving to takers. Does that make sense? And so in an ideal world, you would be getting with people that reciprocate. Doesn't have to be, and you still get the good feel if you don't. But at some point, there's only so many hours in the day. So as I'm focusing on 2025 and going into 2026, it's like, where is my time best spent? Because that's the only commodity we can't get more of. So I'm in my book, I talked about releasing people. Like, they're wonderful people, but they don't need to be a part of the inner circle where you spend a lot of your energy or keep handing slices to. And it's not a perfect science, but a part of my struggle is, oh, they're not responding on something. I'll pour more and I'll pour more. And I was like, I had to just give up because otherwise it's at the detriment of your own emotional well-being too. So you got to be careful with those types of people. And I guess that would be called the takers. They're out there.
Right. Well, and kind of, I think there's this sort of a beautiful relationship possibility where two people almost become competitive about giving, right? A little bit. Where
I've got a few of those and it's so, yes, it's fun. They love it too. It gamifies it to some extent.
Yeah. And what's worse is the whole time you almost feel like you're behind. You're like, oh man, they gave that and so much more. How do I remotely match that? You know, you kind of can't, but you try anyway. And then that other person in the same sort of vein is like, well, they've given an excess, you know, cause like, okay, perfect world. What would be like a great example? You know, just taking it to the bread analogy, right? You know, it's like one person's a builder and the other person's a baker, right? To the baker, it's like, man, I can't, that the amount of effort that goes into you building that thing, like I could thank you so much for helping fix my house. I can never possibly give back in return, you know? And then they're given loaves because it's like, that's what they can give. And then that other person is like, man, I could never perceive baking to the extent that you do. And I get these loaves just all the time for free. You know, it's like you're feeding my family. Right. True. And then the both parties is just so little to them, but much to the other person.
Well, if you read my book, I wrote it to starting out people. So like someone that's been doing it as long as I have, it might seem pretty basic. Someone that's been doing what you've doing, it might seem basic, but I wanted to start from the beginning because we have people joining our team all the time. But it is true that it's not for everybody in terms of wanting to be as excited about it as I am. And that is quite okay too. But if you don't have the people that you're talking about where they have fun in terms of reciprocity, you don't need to have hundreds of those people. You just need to have a few really good people that usually turn into great friends too. One of mine is my life coach and she's like, Schaefer, I'm behind on sending you some great people this year. And I'm like, I'm not keeping track. Hey, like I don't even know where you are compared to other people, but it's interesting that she feels like that. And I just introduce her when I think there's a good match for someone that could benefit from what she does, or she's a wonderful person just for social. It doesn't have to always be in business, but it's just funny how some people, am I at the top of the list this year? I was like, I don't even keep a list. What are you talking about? And some people do in their head, but at the end of the day, it's kind of like just give and don't expect. And then it comes back around. But I probably have four or five of those people that are like her that are just like, I want to help you regardless of anything else going on. So it's kind of nice to be able to have that support from a business standpoint.
Yeah. That's cool. So tell me a little bit more about Searcy Financial specifically. What's kind of some of the clients that you guys are helping? What's some of the things you're doing within that?
We have a reputation, been around for 50 years next year. So April, we're throwing a nice big party to celebrate. But the focus in the beginning was on physicians. Our founder, Mike Searcy, had 100% physician business. And sold disability insurance in the 70s and 80s. So it started out as more of a physician servicing business focused on insurance. But those physicians over time started needing investment management. Let's talk about retirement. Let's talk about long-term care. More than disability was a focus for physicians for sure. But then it turned into comprehensive financial planning. And probably over 10 years ago, we got rid of selling insurance because there's a conflict of interest and led into fee only. And probably I've been here 20 years next year, but it wasn't 100% physicians back then. The firms continued to evolve and I don't know if having a niche is good or bad or indifferent, but what I'm trying to make sure that we're doing is just helping people that need the help, and I don't care where they are. So we still say we help physicians, but I'm not hanging out at the med schools. I'm not giving presentations at KU Med or any of the hospitals. It's just from who we're meeting and who we already know. But I'm leaning in towards, because I enjoy it, helping business owners. Business owners sometimes don't have a lot of wealth outside of the business. And when they do find some money, they pour it back into the business. But those are the conversations I like. What are you doing to grow your business? Who do you need to meet to get there? And what struggles are you having? And that's probably why I enjoy peer advisory groups with other small business owners so much. But that's my focus. John on my team kind of has a different passion about what he likes, and Ryan and Brenda and Jessica. So it's not just me, although a lot of people know who I am because I'm in the community more. It's that we're helping who people can relate to best, and that's not really a niche. But you also know that we started a second company maybe 15 years ago called Allos Investment Advisors. Are you familiar with that?
I may not be. You'll forgive me.
Yeah. So when I 15 years ago, I was 28. And in order to make this business transition from the founder to the current owners, myself included, it needed to have some growth. And at that time, we worked with higher net worth people. And at that time, it was $1 million. You know, now I guess it's higher. But none of my friends had it. So the founder wanted to keep the brand he'd built around helping successful physicians with wealth and said, create a subsidiary company. And we did, called Allos Investment Advisors. It's Latin for one and the same. Manage money the same way, but we have no minimums. So in 28 years old, now my friend that had been somewhere for 5 years had a rollover and wanted to manage money, we could help him with that. And all those people that did that over the last 15 years have needed more services than just investment management. It's turned into Allos having light financial planning. And then it's also turned into Allos being a place where they grow, they stay, their assets become larger, they get married, they have more complicated needs, and now they've graduated to CRC Financial. And our vision for both companies is to bring financial planning to the masses. So not 20 years ago, only wealthy people could afford financial planning. We found a way that we're providing it to anybody who needs it. And it's not for free, so we're still getting paid, but it's an industry that unfortunately a lot of people got disregarded that didn't have money, but young people are the ones that need the planning the most, honestly. So
I do recall you talking about this a little bit now. So thank you. Thank you for bringing that up. That's a good point. And that's a solid model, too. I think it makes a lot of sense to your point and targets both without confusing anybody.
Yep.
That's cool. Okay. So now's the point where I like to do this. We take the proverbial time machine dial, if you will, here. Mm-hmm. And we turn back the clock on Mark Schaefer, right? And so let's just, you know, we're entering a time machine together. We're turning back the dial, right? We exit the time machine and we are staring at Mark Schaefer in high school, essentially. You know, think 16, 17, 18. So in my mind, this is kind of right around the time where you're at this peak sort of, you know, in your younger years, maybe you wanted to be an astronaut, cowboy, sheriff, right? And, well, you know, we got to go to college for something. What's Mark going to go to college for? What's the world telling Mark he needs to be doing? What is Mark thinking in his head he's going to be doing with the rest of his life? Where's Mark geographically?
I grew up in Topeka, Kansas, which great. I'm glad I'm not there. It's a great place to grow up. I went through an interesting high school period where I was very into church. So there's a time where I wanted to be a youth minister and considered playing soccer at Manhattan Christian College, which is in Manhattan, Kansas, right across the street from K-State. There was a period where I got into drugs and I made some bad decisions. So that didn't jive well. I'm kind of an extreme person and I have an addictive personality when it comes to things that I commit to, including bad decision things. So at high school, early on, it was I wanted to be a youth minister and be people. And I liked being in front of groups. I was very into youth group, if people remember that. Back in the Wednesday nights, I'd color my hair a different color and I was that kid.
I'm seeing such a wild juxtapositions too. You'll forgive me. I'm seeing altar boy and drug addict. Help yes. Here, please. What kind of drugs? When, where, and how? And what is this the same period? Are you showing up to church with a joint?
No. I got a job at the mall food court, and that's where I met interesting people that made bad decisions at Westridge Mall in Topeka. And then that priority changed from church into having too much fun. Got involved in a group of people that were doing some. I mean, everybody was doing things in high school, and but it was. As soon as I got to college, I quit all of that. Even in the opening of my book, it was I was more of the bank for people to buy some interesting things. And then I was the entrepreneur to make money on giving people money to buy higher quantities of whatever we were buying. Right. So that was an interesting experience through Westridge Mall in Topeka 25 years ago. And then deciding to go to K-State and where I decided I wanted to be more social. So drinking more at K-State, less on the drug side, marijuana, prescription pills, painkillers, all that stuff you do with drinking when you're not that bright and immature. But I did, it did last long for me. But some of my friends that stayed with it have had some interesting history. I'll just say that. So moved on from a lot of the Topeka people and met my best friends ever at K-State. Unfortunately, a lot of them moved away. A lot of them ended up in Texas. And you could live in Texas and still live 10 hours from each other. None of them live close to each other, so I don't get to see those good buddies as much as I used to. But K-State was formative years for me, and I'm so glad that I decided to go there and pursue. Well, I was going to be an engineer. Did not do that. Now I just appreciate man-made things and woman-made things as it relates to architecture and engineering. But I fell into just relationship stuff. And I don't think I've told you this story, but my parents gave me all the money they saved for me to go to college. And I'm not talking like $100,000. It was, and there wasn't 529 plans back then. It might've been $20,000, which is a young kid. It was a lot. I bought a motorcycle so I could be the guy with a street bike. I also raced motocross in high school. My parents were Harley people. My mom and dad both had them. But I got that $20,000 and I met with their financial advisor and I was like, I kind of want to do what you do. So that kind of opened up the idea to doing it. And he mentored me and got me a job at Edward Jones in Manhattan, Kansas for 2 years while I was in college. So it's worked out pretty good. And the degree, although on the wall, you can't see it, it says Family Studies and Human Services. That's my degree. Now at K-State, it's called Personal Financial Planning. So it's more the relationship side, goal side, money therapy side of finance, not the business side. So very different, but I love that part of our degree and what I do now.
So that was a wild ride. You gave it all very fast. Normally we take it in chunks and we kind of work through the progression. So I'm kind of having a little bit of whiplash here and trying to decide exactly mm-hmm. where to take it. So let me start with kind of like a summary, making sure I'm understanding you correctly. Okay, so you're obviously a people person, right? And you're raised in a church. And so you're raised in a church, you're a people person, you're going to become a minister, right? Now, you get your first job at a
food court.
At a food court. You're a people person. People come in. Fun is fun. And you're hanging out with folks that are doing drugs behind the mall. Fair?
Yep. That's
okay.
Pretty fair.
And then,
yep.
So then probably a little bit less on church at that point, if you add your druthers, which, you know, makes sense. That's kind of a different crowd, probably a more fun crowd. Hopefully I'm not getting shot here, but just saying, looking back
different,
in my own life
different.
On that period, you're right. Different. So
I was also, I'm the type of person that I can get along with anybody too. So that's, you know, some people, what's the word? I could transform into whatever, whoever's with me, which is kind of a good thing. I didn't have to be a part of the popular crowd. Although I liked them, I was a part of every crowd, which I kind of like to be that person.
Well, it's fun to be able to see that. It's an interesting thing. I like this topic. I would like to dive in a little bit more on this because I can relate. Okay. I think sometimes even when you say it like that, the wrong person is like, oh, well, then who are you? Who really is Mark? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you could just change around who you are. But I think they missed something key. We're not changing who we are. I would argue it as I have the opportunity to see the best in everybody in every situation.
Yes. Everybody brings some kind of perspective that needs to be opened and explored. And that's how I think I discovered myself was if you're around everybody that thinks the same, you don't get to become yourself. You're the same of whoever you're with. So I like to diversify that and get different thought perspectives. And I don't, to your point, I don't think I'm better than anybody else either. So it's good to relate up and down, and it makes you proud of where you're at and where you're going or where you don't want to end up, like I started getting into in late high school. So all of that builds character of who you are for sure.
Yeah. No, exactly. So, okay. And then, so that evolves into, you know, you're going to college, K-State. What do you decide you're going to go for? I think we kind of jumped over that a little bit here. Because you're in a situation where like you're, I get it. You're young, you're discovering these are the things that I like, right? And then somewhere in there is college. We're going to go to college and we're going to go to college for this thing. Where do you go from church being a minister you know, food court, back of the food court to that. That's kind of a different.
I did not. Those that know me love, I love K-State. I bleed purple. Actually happened to be wearing it today. But my parents were KU people. I've wanted to disappoint them, I guess, but I had more friends going to K-State than KU. And I didn't come from a family that thought about going out of state. It was a dream. Like, nobody did that. I feel like nowadays, maybe it's because I live in Johnson County. Every kid like goes to these expensive schools. Like, I think it's great that people go to expensive schools, but that wasn't really an option for me. So it was KU or K-State. But K-State had the majors I liked. I love journalism. I wrote for the newspaper in high school, and engineering was probably what I thought people that did well financially did, and people, they do. And then it's almost like I settled into, I guess business is going to be what I do, because I didn't want to do the studio time that engineering required. But the mentor I did meet through an honor society at K-State told me that financial planning wasn't in the College of Business. It was in human ecology, because it was family studies and human services. So he walked me into that program, and it's been really, I've served on their board. I've watched it evolve. I've seen how many people need to come out of financial planning programs around the country because firms like ours can't hire enough. So that's worked out really well for me. And although I only did 4 years at college, it was very formative in relationships and people I met that I still stay in contact with today. Less so in high school, if that makes sense.
Okay. All right. That's fair. Gotcha. And then the financial planning aspect is kind of even instilled further when you receive the money that for college, and that's a seed money for, you know, hey, what do I do with this in a way that's responsible outside of a motorcycle? So makes sense. Okay. That's cool. So tell me about Edward Jones. It sounds like is kind of your big one. I know a lot of Edward Jones folks in the area. I think a big part of it is they're headquartered out of St. Louis, unless I'm wrong. Can you kind of talk through that journey? That is that the seems like the typical start for a lot of folks. Seem like plenty of folks stay there. Seems like plenty of folks come out of there.
And it's evolved a lot in 20 years. So 20 years ago, I worked for her name was DC Hackrett. She used to be a professor at K-State in economics and then became a financial planner at Edward Jones. And I was just an intern, so I didn't do much. But my interpretation of what I'd do if I'd stayed there was it was door knocking time. I don't even know if they do that anymore. And I'm thinking as a 22-year-old, I didn't have the confidence to do sales. And back 20, 30 years ago, the financial planning profession was a sales profession. So it's certainly evolved since then. And I think Edward Jones has evolved too. So I'm not talking bad about it, but it was the industry overall. If you couldn't do sales, it meant you were a bad financial planner. But I'm like, I have people on my team that don't do sales, but they're awesome at taking care of people, helping them reach goals, talking about financial planning. So I think that all of the industry has evolved, and that's been well for me because it let me go to a place to realize I didn't want to do that at Edward Jones and then explore the independent side of being a much smaller company. 20 years ago, there wasn't these small independent financial planning firms like there are today. So that's kind of evolved too. And I happened to land at one that had been around since 1976. So it wasn't a newer, small independent RIA. It was an older one that was open to evolving. But as you know, there's as many small businesses and RIAs as there are big Merrill Lynch's and Edward Jones and the bigger name companies that are still around today, just serving clients a little bit differently. That's all.
Yeah. So, okay. So that's it. So you kind of get started at Edward Jones, which at the time seems very sort of sales heavy, which I would kind of argue. I mean, I don't know the industry as much as you do for sure, but I would think I would say it's definitely still to me seems relatively sales heavy to some end. Because without your book of business, you're kind of in trouble, right?
Well, I bet it's because the people you know are doing the sales. You don't know any of my team that's actually doing more of the servicing because they're not out in the community as much. But yeah, those are the people. So like every business, they need sales, right? You need to create revenue. But when my firm that I've been at for 20 years, the founder was primarily sales. But as we got bigger, I was more of the back office. And at the time we did StrengthFinder by Marcus Buckingham and Gallup, and we've done Culture Index and Predictive Index. But over time, we've hired people with different talents and skill sets. And then we've been able to make sure that they're sitting on the right seat in the bus. My seat just happens to be be out in the community helping people, connecting resources, which leads to some business development. There's 10 other people that you'll never see, but are creating the capacity for me to be able to do that. Because at the end of the day, people got to answer the phone when clients call and do transfers and invest money and research stocks. So it's good that the industry's evolved, but there's certainly still a spot for salespeople like every business.
So can you tell me about that progression within you? Because this is super relatable, frankly, for me. Like I grew up work. Well, I my career path all up until starting Lockbot has been computer engineer, essentially, building systems, server systems, integrating them. And so I know a lot of that architecture, only to kind of discover that, like, well, turns out I'm actually pretty decent at business development. And so then trying to kind of lean into that. Can you tell me through that transition? When was the first time? Because you clearly, you mentioned not having the confidence to think you were going to succeed in the door knocking, right? So you transition, and then you talked about how seriously as it grew, you did a lot of the back office. Can you, when was the, so sounds like you're, I want to zoom in on, you're very back office oriented right now. When's kind of the first moment where it was like, we want you to be the front. We want you to go out and start to do the business development.
Well,
and what does that look like? And when did you actually receive that?
We did Culture Index years ago, and my Culture Index profile as a technical expert, I imagine yours might be too, actually. So at that time, they said, well, Mark's just going to be great behind a computer. I think, meaning like not in front of people, not in sales. I took that as a challenge. Like, all right, I'm going to spend the rest of my time trying to prove that wrong. While I am very technically oriented, you've gotten emails from me. I do include details. I like variety, and what I needed to do to lean into development and sales was create the process around it. So now it's not convincing people to say yes or no in a matter of a meeting. It's pay forward value, help them find ways to stay in front of them. Once you've done that, here's another step in a month and do this. And here's another step in 6 months and add them to a newsletter. And like a series of things that you stay relevant and top of mind, because most people that are hiring us might be working with someone else. So I don't, and people are prospecting to my clients all the time too, but I just want them to know I'm available if someone drops the ball, if they're not happy with something. But it's not the sales, and sales kind of has a bad connotation from 20 years ago. I didn't want to be known as a salesperson. So I kind of just changed my mindset. It's a person that adds value at places. And then to monetize adding value, people hire us for financial planning. And I still do the same stuff of connections, how they should grow their business. And it doesn't have to be about business. Physicians aren't growing a business, but it's a mindset change for me. And it sounds like it was for you too.
Well, and for me, it's okay. So this would be, I remember reading this in the book. So this would be very interesting to talk to you about more too, because I think you and I have flip side of the coin sort of experiences with Culture Index. So mine was, I'm a persuader and or trailblazer. I test as a persuader. Now, my friend, who's a lot better at reading this than I am and reading people than I am, would say the test mistyped you. There's a slight reverse. If you switch these two letters, you're a trailblazer, not a persuader. You're probably actually a trailblazer, which would be more accurate for your personality. That was, it's like, okay, well, what does that mean? It's like, well, it means you're very good at sales, you're very good at relationships, you're very good at, you should lean
taking risk,
right? Yeah. And so it was kind of that moment of like, what happens when I lean into this instead of away from it, right? What happens if I try to prove the test right rather than prove the test
wrong? That's what
you're saying. So yeah, and so it's fun. I don't know, that's interesting, because you make an accurate point of like, look, just because the tests are here doesn't mean they're the gospel truth, right? Doesn't mean you're not going to make a good salesperson. And doesn't mean, and to some, like, you probably enjoy this, right? I would assume that would be, because that's what the test is really saying. The test is really saying, Mark might be really good at it, but he doesn't enjoy it.
Yeah, well, the other thing that you probably know about this is a technical expert, and I've retested and we use the predictive index now. So I should send you, have you taken that one yet?
I haven't taken predictive.
I'm
going to
send it to you because we'll see. My results were 18 years ago, and I think people evolve. And yes, you have natural talents, but I would have confidence now. And I'm actually in the community doing what my profile said I wouldn't do 18 years ago. But I still definitely have the attention to detail. Like, you know, a sales, a persuader might go into a room and talk to everybody and then take away nothing. And then it's kind of like they made a good impression, but I have to like have five follow-ups from the five people I talked about and remember one thing about their kids. And like, there's the detailed end of it for me. And I've written about how to do that through systems and Salesforce or CRMs, but that's the detail part of it. So my predictive index profile as a captain, I don't need all the details. I just need to keep moving forward. I don't like to stagnate, but at the end of the day, it's obvious that I get into the details, which is hard for me to delegate and trust people, but I've also learned to do that over time too. But yeah, I'll send you a link to take the predictive index. It's very similar, but just 18-year difference in time and evolution of what I'm doing now.
How is your firm? So it's clear that you guys lean into personality tests instead of away from it. How has that progression been? Can you kind of talk me through what started on the notion? Has your firm just always done personality tests? What kind of started on the notion that we need to lean into some of these, and how have they been helpful, and how have you been leveraging them?
Yeah, 18 years ago is when we hired Chris Lundin is his name for Culture Index. And he told our small team of, I don't know, five or six, here's your people and here's how best to use them. And over the next 15 years while we were using Culture Index, we tried to hire for weaknesses so that the person that was, we wanted people playing to their talents so when they'd be in flow. And the Culture Index helped us figure out what that was for people. Example, like, I'll make phone calls to people or talk to people, but I don't want to research stocks. So fast forward now, I don't sit on the investment team. I get all the data, I read it in an hour, but I don't sit behind a computer and prepare for 3 hours to meet with our team of six to talk about. I just don't need all of that. So they're doing that now so I can be out making an impact in the community, which leads to more development and everybody's playing their talents. So I will tell you that predictive index we use to hire our administrative coordinator, executive assistant, Amy, she's been with me for 3 months now. She helped plan the book party that we had a month and a half ago. And she's a great person nonetheless, but it's a good pairing. She plays to she knows I'm a little different. Like, some of those profiles say you're different, but it's after you get to know people, you can read them. But hiring her for her profile to work well with mine it's worked really well. So I'm excited about what that means. That was our first hire with the predictive index since we've only been using it a year. But we use it for also getting to know our clients. I have all of our CRC clients take it as a way to get to know them. Not that it's, this is who you are. It's, this is what it says who you are. Now let's talk about how you feel about your results and through that process, get to know them better than if they never did it. So I don't use it to say, I know who you are now. It's tell me if this is you or not as a way to get to know them.
How's that been? How's that look? What can you give an example of, like, when it ended up being a lot of fun or way off?
Oh, well, we do a meeting where we get to know the client outside of all things finance. So I'm talking, tell me how you grew up with money, what order and birth are you from your siblings? Did you have, kind of tell me your money script, and then let's talk about personalities. And sometimes spouses are very different. My wife and I are very different, just like a lot of clients we serve. But sometimes we learn that even though the guy may drive the conversation and want to be high level, the spouse may need and want all the information. So we may structure how we're getting into the details depending on what the personality is, because sometimes I can't read it. We used to have 4-hour meetings at our team, and that means after, I think, 90 minutes, people stop remembering or hearing or listening. So we only have 90-minute meetings at the longest now, but we also now offer 45-minute meetings because some people just like, I'm here to get through this stuff. I don't need to get into the details. Where am I at? What do I need to do? And instead of avoiding us for 6 months or a year and not having a meeting, people will now have a 45-minute meeting every 3 months or every 6 months. And that's better than no meeting, but because they don't like the detail. So it's kind of evolved, but I like using it. And some people like me, I totally disagree with the results there. And I'm like, I did too. Tell me why. And then that's just a good way for them to open up on how they view themselves, which helps me help them better.
Gotcha. That's very interesting. So then you're also using that from a spousal financial conversation perspective then. How's some of that been? Because I feel like I feel like that is the rub when it comes to marriage, right? You're either somehow really good at it, or you're not good at it at all, or you don't know how to talk to each other, or, you know, and how you grew up with money definitely changes things drastically, right? It's been a very interesting evolution just for me and my wife, even from the perspective of, you know, hey, here's how I grew up in this situation. It's like, oh, that explains why you do that. Here's how I grew up in this situation. It's like, wow, okay, that explains how you do that. And this conversation in particular, you know, I'll go as far as to say it's been an evolution, because the truth of the matter is, I think in a perfect world, she and I would both rather not talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a funny story. One couple I did that with, it was obvious they weren't planning their future together. So elephant in rooms can become pretty apparent. This couple is no longer married. They're very good to their daughter that they share, and there's nothing wrong with that. And they're happily in other relationships now. But most couples, especially you and young kids, I think you have another one on the way. Like, it's, you can't think about next week, let alone like 3 years and retirement in 30. And then if you want to leave a legacy when you're gone. So the facilitation and not forcing it, but welcoming it, is kind of what we create a safe zone for. And spouses learn things about the others that they don't otherwise talk about. Or even some people, like, I've never thought about leaving. Like, I don't know. And so you plant seeds, because I think if people get asked that, just the way they think beyond the meeting starts evolving into who they become or want to be. Because if you're never challenged to that, you're just trying to get through the day. I mean, that's most people that are in young families, for sure. So I love that meeting. And it's funny when the spouses look at each other, and some of them are like, you go first, I want to hear what you say. Then we also uncover, like, where their passions are from a not-for-profit standpoint. Like, if you're passionate about it, but your money and giving isn't matching it, are you passionate about it? Not that you have to give money, but a lot of money is the tool to do all these things in life. We just happen to make that the priority in the beginning to lay the foundation. So yeah, I think you would lean into that conversation, but you'd probably learn something about your spouse too.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
And I have a financial planner on my team too, that helps my wife and I, because otherwise I'm the financial planner. So I just tell my wife, here's how we're doing it. But with our financial planner that is on my team, he takes it out of, well, Mark's just saying, my wife just hears what Mark's doing because that's what Mark's doing, to our financial planner saying, this is what's best for the family. It might be the same exact thing, but it's different when it's coming from someone leading on the other side of the table too.
Okay, so I've figured out now, we're going to go a completely different direction here with questioning. Are you familiar with the book Killing Sacred Cows by chance?
I have read it a few years ago. Jeff Palacio introduced me to the book, I believe. Yes.
Okay, fantastic. So I kind of use that book as like the antidote to say, like, the Dave Ramsey sort of philosophical trend.
Yep.
Let's start to talk about some of that a little bit. What's your opinion on this Dave Ramsey, Robert Kiyosaki? And then we're actually starting to see now, there's this very interesting gentleman, gosh, I wish I could remember his name, Caleb something's last name. He's a social media influencer now. His kind of claim to fame is, on air, he reads through their financials, and then he basically just yells. I mean, look, these are the clips that I see, and nothing against him. It's his brand, and it works quite well for him. But he basically kind of like berates them on air, and people opt into this at this point. They're like, they get so desperate that they're like, maybe I need a tough talking to. And so he flies them in, and they sit in this sort of podcast style thing, and they just talk through, and he kind of berates them, for lack of any better term. But then he also lays out a budget for them, to his credit. And I think he's even been known to do things like, hey, look, I hate saying this, but you probably need to declare bankruptcy. Oh. We will help counsel you through that, which I'm just glad that people are having that conversation, because I feel like, total contrast, there's a lot of people that I run into that it's like, hey, you know, XYZ passed away, inherited some money, and it's like, okay, fantastic. One of my first questions is legitimately like, cool, have you talked to a financial planner or a financial advisor? And they're, no, I don't need to do that. And it's like, oh, okay. Why don't you need to do that? And it's like, well, it's not a lot of money. And, you know, I'm just going to do this with it. And I'm like, well, okay. That may be the right call. That may not be the right call. It would be nice, wouldn't it? Somebody that does this. So I'm not exactly sure what question I'm going to get to, but I guess the question is this: what's your opinion on the atmosphere with regards to financial planning and philosophy? And how do we turn it around such that kids are exiting high school and actually have like a good head on their shoulders for what they're going to do with their money?
Yeah, that's a good question. I taught a high school personal finance, not a whole course, but for a couple hours, and it's required in Missouri. This was 10 years ago. I don't know if Kansas ever caught up, but I think that it should be a requirement for high school and college. I mean, if I have to do public speaking, I should have to learn about finance in college, right? So I think that it's important that people do it. Now, the things that are making social media and the things that grab attention are kind of short-sighted or solution-driven, which I think are fine to an extent. But the real value of financial planning is the relationship of ongoing advice and perspective on what someone said was important that is evolving. And maybe their goals and needs and wants do evolve. But sometimes because you inherited money, you spend money forgetting about the future. You can either use it to make a difference or set yourself up for success. But a lot of people think short-sighted. So as financial planner, it's the perspective. Like I think I can do great financial planning for my wife and I, but the fact that someone else on our team can help with it kind of takes us out of our own mind. Like at some point we don't need to build more. Like we have enough, we're on track. We should take the kids to Disney World. There's enough, right? But in my mind, it's just got to work, hustle, make bigger. And I like and enjoy that game. But my wife reminds me of a day, the work's going to be there tomorrow. And we do have enough right now. Like stop. Not that I'm worrying it. That's just my personality. So I think the perception of what other people bring outside is valuable from a financial planning perspective. So I don't know if I answered that question, but it's certainly, I feel like we clean up the mess of what a poor financial planner did for someone else before, because there's bad financial planners out there too. Or people don't know better. And ignorance doesn't win when it comes to your finances, especially the longer you go down a trail of ignorance and it's in the wrong direction, the harder it can be to correct it. And you feel good about it because you don't know until it matters. And that's a lot of times the realization when we meet with new people that haven't done a good job.
Yeah. Well, it's a very, yeah, it's a really interesting thing because it's easy when you're the external party to have an opinion in somebody else's life. But it is one of those things where it's like nobody can make somebody else make decisions or choices.
Well, an AI can gather all the facts, but it's still not going to have the relationship side of the trust you should have in your advisor. Like, if you don't have trust in your advisor, you probably shouldn't be working with them. They might be doing a great financial planning, but if you can't have a vibe and a trust and be open with them, you got to have that with a financial planner too. So AI can't create that trust or give them perspectives on what they've seen work for other people or give stories. So I'm not as worried about that, but a lot of the general advice that makes the headlines, Dave Ramsey has great broad advice for everybody, but you're not everybody. You know what I'm saying? Everybody's uniquely different in what their goals and needs and wants are. And that's where an individual relationship usually makes more sense.
Well, and I think it's particularly interesting too, because what I personally feel like a lot of people miss on is, you know, these folks have a brand, right? Dave Ramsey has a very clean black and white brand. And it's been interesting. He's interviewed people on the other side of the brand. And I think he's even said something akin to the lines of like, look, your way of doing things clearly isn't wrong. It is way different and way riskier than what I would do it, which, oh, yeah, I think is the most you'll kind of get him to kind of like meet you in the middle. But from a brand voice perspective, they kind of need to say the same thing virtually every single time. You know, Robert Kiyosaki, he preaches debt. You know, he's like, I've got more debt than, and at some point it's the bank's problem, not my problem, which polar opposite of Dave Ramsey. Also something very dangerous if not handled carefully, right?
True. If I didn't use debt, I wouldn't have my house, right? I mean, you got to use debt for something, or a lot of people, a college education, but there's good college education and bad, not bad ones, ones that don't have the return on the investment, I guess is the best way to put that.
Right. And if you're not careful, there's plenty of folks that view the right motorcycle as a good investment, right?
Yep. Yep.
So where should folks start? So let's imagine somebody's listening now, right? It's like, what's a wealth advisor? What's a financial planner? I don't have a clue. I don't, you know, and to Dave Ramsey's credit, for sure, my first one came about as a result of Dave Ramsey talking about mutual funds. I had no clue what a mutual fund was at the time. The bank I was with, local credit union, had this office labeled wealth advisor. And I walked in and said, I don't know what a mutual fund is. And I don't know what an IRA is. Dave Ramsey says I need one. And that was just such an eye-opening experience, especially because the way it worked out, it's not like I was billed anything for that day, for that time. And so I was like, oh, wow, you're just going to do this? So that's cool.
True. That's part of earning business to some extent. Give away free advice or put a spotlight on the value that someone could add. Yeah, I think that the initial thing is getting a house in order in terms of being prepared and ready to engage a financial planner. If you don't have discretionary cash flow, they can still add some value, but at some extent you need to get an emergency fund, you need to get your career in order, something. And like, usually it's people that are a few years after college or at a point where they're maybe spending less than they're making. So they have excess, and the question becomes what I should do with the excess. Or if it's not, it's maybe less about a financial planner and more about a financial coach that does more of the financial budgeting help. But we don't do a lot of that. We can lean on apps now that do that. Monarch Money is one that I've used with clients. But to financial planning is more of long-term vision on what you want to buy a house, retire, leave money to somebody. But how you do it, not only is a mutual fund what you learned, well, what kind of account, a Roth, traditional, tax impact on all of it. Do you have an employer that offers a 401k, and do they have a match? Like, someone that can see the big picture for you, because at the end of the day, you don't know what you don't know. And just typing into Google or chat to say, where should I start? Given that it doesn't know where you're at, it needs to be with a person. So just an introductory meeting with someone is a good one. I prefer certified financial planners. I am one. My team has a handful of people on my team have that credential. Those are the ones that have experience and knowledge to give that overview, and then let them tell you how they can help long term, not sell you products, how they can provide a service. Fiduciary is a big word in my industry too. If you're familiar with it, it's someone that is someone is helping you if they were in your shoes with their knowledge and experience, not selling you XYZ product because they make a commission on it. So be careful from that.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the CFP. I'm actually reminded part of my journey started because of a podcast called Radical Personal Finance. The gentleman that ran it had just tested for a CFP, and he had this wild way of talking through things that was very eye-opening at the time, for sure. Well, like, he talked about, you know, spending your time wisely, essentially, your time and your money wisely. And then he talked about something as silly as the way I was raised in kind of the Dave Ramsey camp, right? Is it's like you mow your own lawn for the sake of saving that money, right? And then he's like, but if you absolutely hate mowing your lawn and that's time that you could save that increases your quality of life, but then also you can put that time towards something you enjoy more that receives a higher return. And it was like a completely radical, he goes through, opportunity cost. Mm-hmm. He explains opportunity cost for the first time. That's the first time I'd ever heard that term. And I was like, whoa, this is just like a brand new wild notion to me of like, the example I gave was you could go buy an SUV for 50 grand, or you could travel to 100 countries for 50 grand. It's like most people don't go in buying that SUV thinking they're not traveling to 100 countries as a result.
I think that it's also how you're raised. To your point, another book that's good is Buy Back Your Time, right? You buy back
Great
your time
book.
by buying Dan Martell. To mow your lawn. Yep. But my dad raised me to change my own oil, like, and he is 72 and changes his own oil. Just finally had someone mow his grass when he went through some health issues. And that's hard for him. Like, it's hard. And I'm like, he can't believe the way that I do that. But the other day, it's like, I already have very little time with my kids. Like, I need the time outside of work. And my work hours are more than, I earn more than what I would be paying someone to do these things. And I don't necessarily love it, right? And so I can tell you that that's opened up more things. And just hiring the administrative coordinator, I could either work until midnight, three nights a week, or I can work until 10 instead of midnight and just have more free time and sleep better. So it's trading time. But also, if you're in a business, it's like anything else. I don't know how to draw it, but your expenses are going up in business. But as long as your revenue is going up higher, they're not, they're diverging, not converging. There means there's more profit being created. Then, man, that was a pretty good expense. And the same could be said on the personal budget life side as well. It's just harder to look at because nobody does that math like they do in their own business with QuickBooks or whatever they're using. But yeah, I definitely agree with that. But my background is you just don't spend money. It's very different. I've changed a lot from where I grew up, which is a good thing. And now my wife thinks I went too far on the other side. So we're working on that too.
Are you familiar with the book Business Secrets from the Bible by chance? We're talking.
I'm not, but I should probably read it.
Well, the reason so he brings up I hope I'm not butchering this, but I don't think I am. He'd indicate that it's actually something that the Jewish culture is particularly good at. And it's kind of bringing it back full circle to like the example of the baker and the builder, right? They do a really, really good job of, look, I'm a baker or watchmaker might be a great example. And this is what I specialize in. This is the return I can get for that watchmaking. Obviously, why would I spend the time and effort to do an oil change when that person's really, really good at that, or to bake when that person's really, really good at that, or to build when that person's really, really good at that? So I'll spend the money here because it will be, and it's interesting because it comes back to the reciprocity conversation we were just talking about, right? What might seem in the moment like a lot of money to me, hiring an expert to do this thing, something that ideally takes them little effort for maximum lift. In reality, what's happening when everybody's doing that in a community together is the entire
one plus one equals three instead of one plus one equals two. Yep.
That's beautiful. Yes.
Or have you heard the example, another parable, and this isn't from the Bible, but see if I could tell it right. You're on your deck and there's a creek and you're mad about it and you can't figure out how to fix it. So you hire a guy to come over. He comes over and within a minute he goes over and pounds one thing in. Creek is gone. The guy leaves after 5 minutes. Here's your bill for $200. And the guy goes, you were here for not an hour, 5 minutes. He goes, well, the bill was for the experience to know exactly where to go put that. You could have spent 5 hours and never gotten it, had 100 nails. It's the experience you're paying for that he's an expert at. So the same could be said in lots and lots of businesses. So yes, I agree with all of that. I will, you might have to send that book title to me. I have just joined a group called Acumen that brings faith into business. And so that's more of a priority for me. So I'm leaning into that stuff more. So if you remember, send that to me.
Yeah, no, for sure. I really enjoyed the book. It kind of changed it's written by a rabbi, which I think kind of helps because the reason I think it helps is because he brings perspective on verses that I never had because he'll dive into the original Hebrew. So, for example, one of my favorite analogies he gives, and it's in that same book, is I'm going to butcher this, so you'll forgive me, but I think I've got a pretty good handle on it. When God takes the rib and creates woman, it's in the original, in English, it says woman. And Adam says, this is woman because she came in my body. When in English, it's woman both times. That's how it's translated. In Hebrew, it's actually a different spelling, a slight variation. And it's a slight, if I remember correctly, it's a slight variation on Adam. And what Adam is basically saying is, I find my identity in this person. Yep. And it's just a much deeper meaning than...
Yeah, I've never heard that.
Yeah, and so it's... Because it's an interesting thing. So what's missed, I think, sometimes is, like, you know, the Bible says helper and the rib. But in the original Hebrew, it actually really looks like it. And it goes into the next verse, for this reason, man and woman will leave their parents and be joined together as one. In the original Hebrew, it's a much deeper, meaningful, like, no. These people are not only going off and becoming one separate from their parents, they're navigating life together and discovering one's own identity, such as their name, within the other person.
Yep. They still can be totally different and support each other, but they're one in where they're going. Yes, I would agree with that.
Yeah. And it's like when he described that in the original Hebrew in that way, I was just like, whoa, I've never read that. So I had to like reread it. It's an interesting thing.
Acumen brings up things like that, too, in terms of the way that we start our monthly meetings, relating business principles to scripture. And just as an adult now, having been through interesting times that we've talked about, it's a much different perspective. And you can read the same book 10 years apart, and it's a totally different book given where you're reading it at the time, Bible or any book. So I just like that acumen focus brings that back to faith, which is at the end of the day a priority for us at this point, not so much in my late high school days.
Yeah. And it's I like these groups too, because they almost seem to their take on it is different than maybe even what I grew up with. Another one, I think it's God with You at Work. If I'm getting it right. And his take on business ownership and faith is just like radically different than what I expect. And he brings in like Paul and Barnabas and these folks that were we know they were impactful, right? We read the book, but what we miss on is the fact that, like, not only were they impactful from a religious Christian faith perspective, they were specifically impactful in that realm because they were known in their community, they were well written, they were well read, and they had a strong business sense, and they could actually support themselves and others around them financially to some degree. Beyond needing support, they needed support too, obviously, but they were in a position where they were capable of making an impact, and they were capable of making an impact because they could write really, really well. And they could write really, really well because, I mean, he worked for the Roman Empire. You know, he was a very prestigious and persecuting Christians there for a while until flipped around. And so it's just interesting because they conducted business on the side to help fund. And there's a lot of what we miss sometimes.
Yeah. And I thank you for introducing me to Barnabas Group. You just mentioned Barnabas, but that's, I planned to be at the meeting on February, so I'm sure I'll see there.
Yes, please, 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 please. Hopefully we end up at the same table. That would be fantastic.
For sure.
George, have you met George yet, by the way?
Twice now. Yep, traded an email this morning with him. Introduced him to two organizations already. It's been a fun. That was a month ago when you introduced us, so it's been good correspondence since.
I went to brag a little bit and to kind of double back on what you were talking about on nonprofits. Thanks to Barnabas, we've been much more involved in giving back to the community in a way that, I mean, we've always kind of given back to the community, leadership academies, things like that. But this is, I think, the first time where it's been a little bit more meaningful and impactful. There was a nonprofit that came up that spoke that kind of hit with me. And I was able to go and speak in front of the kids and kind of doubling back to the, like, you know, not being it was really interesting to be in that room. Because these were underserved youth, essentially. And what was wild to me is, like, on one hand, yeah, they're definitely rough on the surface, right? And they may not have cared too much to listen to me, although I think I got through to some of them. But what was wildly interesting to me was you could tell each one had their own personality and their own strengths. And it was upsetting in my mind to, like, you know, so some of these kids are discounted by so many people, and yet I see really cool things in each one. Like, there was this one girl, she didn't want to shake my hand. She didn't want to give me her name either. She's just, like, very much like, eh, don't talk to me. And I finally got her name, and she didn't shake my hand, but that's all right. What was interesting was later they had to vote for another student. She struggled to pick between two names, so she ended up writing down both names. And she was the only one to vote for those kids.
Mm.
Yeah. Nobody else voted for those kids. And it was kind of interesting because it was like, you could tell she sees the people that other people don't see.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
So there's two questions we wrap up pretty consistently with. So over here at Lockbod, we have a motto that goes, if we have seen further, it's by standing on the shoulders of giants. This fun derivative on a quote that Isaac Newton gave. Who's been a giant in your life that you'd like to pay homage to in this moment?
Oh, well, that's always been Mike Searcy for business. I've also got personal ones, and some of them are mentioned in my book. But that's exactly why I came to this company, was attracted to Mike from the beginning. It was a small company. From the beginning, he said, there's an opportunity to own this. He stayed true to everything he said. His advice from 20 years ago or 10 years ago is making sense today. Yes, it's Mike. I could have worked this hard at another company and not been given the opportunity. Not that I had to be an owner, but I knew that was my end game. And just life advice from him on other things. I still call him. He retired last year. He's been in Florida for 8 years, so he hasn't lived here in a while, but still a lot of things he did from the beginning has been a good thing. So it's been fun to stay connected. I look forward to enjoying bourbon with him, although he might not drink anymore. I'll drink a bourbon with him in Florida over the next several years just to continue to thank him for what he's built.
That's cool. So the second one, and I have a sense for what you might say here, but the second one is, if you added kind of a pithy or general saying that you found to be true again and again and again in your life, what would it be?
I always use this one. Don't let the things you want make you forget the things you have. A lot of times we're all wanting, we're trying to grow, we're trying to make more revenue in business. But at the end of the day, it's pretty good what we have. Like, it means enough, you have enough. So don't be short-sighted in what you want. Remember what you have. That's what that quote's about. I also have other ones on my screen. I have this, 5 Regrets of the Dying. Have you read the book?
No!
You can't read any of it. Yeah, I always remind myself of what the 5 regrets are, because sometimes you're so busy that you don't want to have those regrets. So make decisions based on that too. It's a book by a hospice nurse that learned what lots of these dying people regretted and wrote a book about it.
I think I'm really going to like this book.
Yeah, it's
sorry.
It's
I have
good.
To like add it right now because this is my speed, man. I'm always kind of the opinion that, like, because everybody wants to avoid talking about dying, but we all get there. And it's kind of all how do we
some people
the
get
regrets?
There young, some people get there old. But yeah, it's if you live your life not to have regrets, then you might make different decisions today. That's all that was a reminder of.
Yeah, man. If there was one single truth that's just like it or hate it, it comes for us all. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And you could be Mother Teresa or literal Hitler. It comes for
one
us
more
all.
Quote. I'm just looking at my screen. I don't know about you, but I've got things in the bottom. So this one is the newest one. There is a version of yourself 10 years from now that is begging this version of yourself to enjoy where you currently are a little bit more. Because sometimes you always think it's going to be better. And, you know, you look back in the good old days. When my kids were 2, it was awesome. Like, why didn't I enjoy it? I was just not sleeping, right? So that's just a constant reminder for me, too.
That's good. Thank you so much for joining me today, Mark. I've really enjoyed this and enjoyed being able to interview you. And yeah, I appreciate you.
Yep. I look forward to continue the conversation on and offline. So it was good to talk. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, everybody.
Yep.
Hello, everyone. I wanted to thank you for listening to today's episode. It's such a blessing to be able to interview some such fantastic individuals. If you're interested in listening to more, we look to post every Thursday at 10 a.m. You can find us on YouTube, Amazon Music, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much. Have a blessed day.